dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of uncommon intelligence who brings it to bear extraordinarily helpfully at the Investigative Project on Terrorism, that is the famous Steve Emerson's outfit, is its senior counterterrorism analyst, John Rossomondo. He is a very accomplished investigative journalist. He has been writing brilliantly on a variety of issues, but most helpfully, I think, on this question of what I call the enemy within, the degree to which we in the United States face, specifically from Sharia supremacists, a mortal threat inside our own country. He has recently penned two pieces that we're going to talk about very briefly today at the Investigative Project on Terrorism's site, and that is investigativeprojectonterror.org. One involves the meeting that took place recently with the Vice President of the United States back in September. John, let me just say, first of all, hello. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for the work you do. And tell us about this meeting of the so-called Faith-Based Community Safety and Security Symposium. What was it about and who was there?
It was a symposium about mosque and religious place of worship, security in the wake of the white supremacist attacks, the Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh last year, and the mosque attack we saw in New Zealand back in the spring. And, surprisingly, the leaders of the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations, which is the U.S. Muslim Brotherhood umbrella group that encompasses groups like CARE,
the Council on American Islamic Relations, yeah,
American Muslims for Palestine, and the Darul Hijra Islamic Center, which, you know, notorious Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Muslim Brotherhood linked mosque here outside of the nation's capital. Their executive director was included by the name of Osama Jamal. He's a close person to Turkish President Recep Erdogan. He was one of about 180 participants. Also included was the Muslim Public Affairs Council, which has a history of anti-Semitism. Its executive director, President Salam al-Mariati, called the Holocaust kind of war propaganda to, you know, cause the Palestinians to pay the price for Nazi Germany's sins.
So these are the kind of people that the United States government should not be treating with at all, let alone putting in the room with the Vice President of the United States, I would suggest. Interestingly enough, I was at the White House for a meeting on another subject, John, when this was going on, and a young woman was welcoming people to the symposium outside the security fence and asked me if I was going to that meeting, and I said no, but I think I should be. Because honestly, I have the feeling that most of the people in the room have no idea what you do, about what the USCMO is up to, what MPAC is up to. These are Brotherhood Front organizations who are committed, as I think you've reported on, John, as if we at the Center for Security Policy, to a mission that has been described by one of the leading Brotherhood operatives, Muhammad Akram, in a famous memorandum introduced into evidence in the largest terrorism financing trial in U.S. history. Their mission is being destroying Western civilization from within, for heaven's sakes. And especially, you know, a person who is closely aligned with Recep Tayyip Erdogan, one of the world's preeminent Sharia supremacists, is a problem, whether the president has got that particular thing locked down or not. And John, this reminds me of something that I just wanted to visit with you about. I consider really the high water mark of anybody in public life, understanding and articulating what needs to be done in the face of these various Sharia supremacist threats, to have been the president's address back on the 15th of August, 2016, when he was candidate Trump running for office. And he really laid out, soup to nuts, a comprehensive program for dealing what he called dealing with what he called radical Islamic terrorism. The one promise that he hasn't kept yet out of that, at least in part, is basically what he promised to do about those who are radicalizing in our communities, which seemed to me to be a pretty good way of describing, if not by name, certainly by its purpose, the Muslim Brotherhood front organizations. We don't seem to see progress on that front, designating the Brotherhood as a terrorist organization or in other ways, to say nothing of treating with them as you've been describing. Why is that, as you see it?
Well, as I see it, based on people I've spoken with, the bureaucracy, like State Department, Defense, National Security Council, they just sort of dismiss it all as like conspiracy theories. They don't have an understanding of, psychology. And the thing about this meeting that was most egregious is that DHS previously revoked the $400,000 grant to the Muslim Public Affairs Council due to its unhelpful narratives about the war on Islam, which is the single most used talking point by jihadist recruiters. I mean, groups like MPAC, groups like CARE, they exist to alienate the Muslim community from the rest of America and to create an us versus them dichotomy that terrorist recruiters then are able to use to say that, CARE and MPAC, they're not doing enough. So you have to turn to violence.
Right. Well, and I would argue, John, that even before you get to that point, what they're certainly are doing are trying to keep these people disassimilated, shall we say, from the rest of society so they can dominate them. The brothers, the Sharia supremacists, even if they don't get them all the way to, radical violent jihad, they're nonetheless involved in sort of this Sharia supremacist enterprise in what I call the pre-violent mode. And John, I guess one last thing quickly. One of the purposes of these brotherhood organizations is to promote and try to use democratic processes, as Erdogan himself has done, to gain power. You wrote recently about Ilhan Omar, very quickly, about her operations and what the USCMO is actually accomplishing in this regard.
Well, the USCMO is supporting candidates across America who support the Brotherhood's agenda. You know, Erdogan described democracy as a train to get to their ultimate goal, which is, Sharia domination and gaining power.
It's a trolley, I think he said, that you get off when you get to your destination. And that's certainly what he has done, isn't it? And unfortunately, what we're going to need to come back to you on, because we're out of time today, is the success that the USCMO is having in bringing some of these Sharia supremacists to office. But that will be for another time. John, thank you so much for what you do at the Investigative Project on Terrorism. I really encourage our audience to follow your work. It's pathbreaking often and desperately needed. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Grant Newsom is with us next. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined, I'm very pleased to say, by Grant Newsom. He is a retired colonel in the United States Marine Corps. He's been trained as an attorney. He's been a foreign service officer. He has been a senior executive, mostly working for American companies in Japan. And he is these days the senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. He is not least a founding member of the Committee on the Present Danger China and a great duty expert on what the Chinese are up to and a very valued colleague and great guest. Always pleased to have him. Grant, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Oh, thanks very much. Glad to be here.
So I caught a terrific piece that I read recently at And Magazine and can be found at andmagazine.com, the home of our friend Charles Faddis as well, talking about the Chinese psychological operations campaign that has been run against this country with stunning success, I think it's fair to say. Talk us through what the Chinese have done and how they've done it and the effects.
Sure. I'm glad to cover that. The Chinese have really just played to American avarice, naivete, ignorance, hubris over the last really 40 years, quite successfully, and really have managed to get, if you go down the list, American business, financial industry, Wall Street, government officials, our political class, academia, Hollywood, the media, even the U.S. military, to take the wrong view of China, so that all those groups, or at least very large parts of them, and there are exceptions, do view China as unthreatening, attractive, really an indispensable country, and effectively do what China wants. And it's really been quite an accomplishment. You find that you have to step back and really in some awe of what the Chinese have been able to do by understanding their target and making the right appeals to it and getting really very favorable policy decisions, investment decisions, and even, as I said, even in the U.S. military, just a very naive sense of China.
And you have a passage here that I just want to quote from the piece at End Magazine, Grant. You said, quote, "It didn't have to fire a shot. More impressive, it got the Americans to assist and even fund the effort. Convinced that the PRC was unthreatening, or could be made so, indispensable, and a gold mine," unquote. That really seems to capture it. And how did they accomplish this? Was it a product of Deng Xiaoping's famous hide and bide strategy as much as anything, sort of deception and secretiveness? Or was it corruption? Was it something else, or all of the above?
All of the above, but it's really striking just how little effort the Chinese had to make. In the case of U.S. business, present China as open for business, as this potential gold mine. And you're hard pressed to find a major American company and even many smaller ones that have not gone all out in the China market, even though the long-term profits have not been there. They've built up their competition. They've got into a market without a legal system, and where the government's intentions are to actually destroy them and replace them with a Chinese company. I used to work for Motorola. They went into China, did everything right. And this was right after Tiananmen Square massacre. And Motorola did everything right, and they effectively committed suicide. They built up their competition, handed over technology, and that was Motorola. And everyone is still there, just about. Boeing, Tesla, General Electric, Pratt & Whitney, just go down the list. Everyone has this dream of making a ton of money. And it really, over the long term, it's very doubtful that is going to happen.
Suicide is an interesting way of putting it. I mean, they certainly set themselves up for it. But I think homicide is actually more appropriate, because they were taken out by the Chinese in a very disciplined, systematic way. In fact, Grant, we had a program of the Committee on the Present Danger China in Chicago a few months ago, in which we were talking with people who were also in the electronics industry or telecommunications industry at various points in the past, and who had a similar experience to Motorola's. They literally were eliminated by the Chinese as a result of predatory trade practices and technology theft, and in some cases simply buying their products or their productive capacity lock, stock, and barrel, and transferring it to China. It's an amazing story, and unfortunately not unique to this particular sector of our industrial base. Just that's a particularly egregious example of it, right?
Oh, exactly. And you know, you move down the list and you have Wall Street, which has always been just keen to get into China and still is. And what they're effectively doing is providing the Chinese regime with convertible currency. But that was just, it is unrelenting in, say, Wall Street's desire to get in and the entire financial industry. And so the Chinese really have to do very little. It is this appeal to American avarice, really human nature. And it hasn't stopped at all. And, one hardly knows what to say. And additionally, you have, Chinese have done very well with America's political class. I think every administration until this one, and unfortunately, even Ronald Reagan, every one of them has bent over backwards, has fallen for this belief that China could be transformed into a sort of a liberal democracy almost if we just accommodated them enough. And so this has been a bipartisan achievement, unfortunately.
Achievement is perhaps not the right word for it, but it's been equally a bipartisan blame, I guess, is the point you're making. And Grant, I just wanted, coming to the military, because as you've indicated in your piece at AND Magazine, you'd think the military would at least be clear-headed about this and be sensible about the degree to which, especially as it's become more and more obvious in recent years that China is building up, thanks in part to our investments and other technology transfers and help, a very formidable military capacity directed clearly at neutralizing ours. And yet there is evidence that the military has been as addled about this as some of the other institutions. Talk about this in the context, if you would, of this exercise that's just been completed between elements of the People's Liberation Army and the U.S. Army in Hawaii.
There's been an idea for many years that in the U.S. military, that if you engage with China, if you do training with them and you go meet with them.
Military to military exchanges, right?
Yes, that's right. That will somehow result in a sort of a friendly China that decides that America is their friend. And that since there's nothing to worry about from the Americans, well, China was supposed to become a nicer country, a nicer military as well. But it's this belief that engagement is good without actually keeping score and seeing what the results have been. And it has not resulted in a sort of a less threatening Chinese military, quite the contrary. But this has been really standard practice. Just take PACOM or Indo-PACOM these days, that there have been commanders out there over the years who have just been full bore for engagement and who would just studiously go out of their way to not to refer to China as an adversary. And it's, you know, this is still going ongoing. And it's ironic, but if not insane, that, you know, the Trump administration pulled the invitation, the PRC's invitation to the latest RIMPAC exercise, you know, finally standing up. And then they, in just short order, the U.S. Army keeps doing joint training operations with the PLA.
Which is having the practical effect, as have all these military exchanges, it seems to me, of actually conveying insights into how we do business, training, in effect, this adversary, this enemy, to be more lethal as they actually come against us in due course, probably. We'll be talking more about that with two of our subsequent guests. But let me just ask, because this is happening not just to us, but other countries are beginning to awaken to the nature of China as well. And you're based out there in the Western Pacific, Grant. And I just wondered, as you've been studying this, what can you tell us quickly about what seems to be the realization in Australia of the challenge that we're now facing from the Chinese?
Well, the Australians woke up a few years ago to the threat, and they move very quickly to try and take some measures to sort of stem the Chinese influence and subversion that's taking place in Australia. And of course, when I say Australians, it's really in the sort of the conservative side of the political spectrum that have had power, and they've actually moved very quickly. not least to just recognize they had a problem. And it's partly a function of scale. It's a smaller country, it's smaller government, so they can actually, they don't have quite as many challenges to doing something fast. But it's the Australians who have really shown us what we need to do. And it'd be nice to see the U.S. and the Australians really cooperate more on that. So it's both domestic subversion that the Australians have had to deal with, but also a very successful political warfare campaign by the Chinese in the Southwest Pacific, which has traditionally been Australian's sort of area of interest.
Grant, this is a topic to which I hope we can return with you soon. In the meantime, let me simply say thank you for your service to our country in the past, in the Foreign Service, as well as the United States Marine Corps, and that you're rendering really to all of us at the moment in your capacity as the Senior Research Fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. I know you keep up the good work. Come back to us again soon, if you would, sir.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a thrill to be able to say we have with us once again a man I have the highest regard for his service to our country over many decades, as well as his intellect and his corporate memory about one of the lost arts in the national security space, nuclear weaponry, both the policy, the technology, the implications, and the thought, now I think widely disproved, that one can usefully engage in arms control to restrict nuclear capabilities, particularly those of secretive and usually deceptive governments like those of Russia before the Soviet Union and, of course, communist China as well. His name is Dr. Mark Schneider. I first met him about 30-some years ago when we served together in the Department of Defense. He continued to do that for most of the intervening period. He is also a former Foreign Service officer. These days, he's a senior fellow with an indispensable organization, the National Institute for Public Policy, a very powerful commentator on and analyst of these important topics. And I wanted to talk with him most immediately about an important piece that he had recently at Real Clear Defense. But first, let me say, Mark, welcome back, my friend. It is so good to have you with us. Thanks for taking a few minutes.
Well, thank you very much. A very kind introduction.
Well-deserved and absolutely heartfelt. So at Real Clear Politics, you summarize something that we've talked about several times recently, which is these exercises that the Russian Federation has been undertaking, often presided over by Vladimir Putin himself. One, though, that is particularly ominous is something that was called Thunder 2019. Tell us about it, Mark, this exercise that took place in October. What did it involve and what was Putin up to?
Well, apparently it was the largest ever large strategic nuclear exercise. The Russians released vastly more detail about it than they ever had previously done on a nuclear exercise. And the obvious reason, of course, is to try to scare the West. They staged an exercise which started off with a tactical nuclear preemptive strike against NATO and apparently either U.S. bases in the Pacific or possibly U.S. bases, Japan, and even possibly South Korea in the Pacific area. The scope of it was mammoth. And if you look at the numbers that they released, it involved over at least 250 strategic nuclear delivery vehicles, and the exercise ended in a massive nuclear strike where all or nearly all of the Russian forces involved simulated actual launches of their strategic nuclear weapons. So you're dealing with many, many hundreds of warheads. All these missiles, or apparently all these missiles, are heavily MIRVed, so you're dealing with a lot of weapons. So they simulated the end, all-out massive nuclear war.
Against the United States itself, not just NATO. This is American bases and other facilities and targeted. And again, the role that Vladimir Putin himself...
Yes, he ordered the launches. I mean, that's the unique thing about these exercises for many, many years, that Putin personally presides over them. As I said, they start out typically with a tactical nuclear strike and end up with a massive strategic nuclear strike.
And this involves, to be clear, Mark Schneider, the first use of nuclear weapons. You've mentioned preemptively in the theater, but also you would assess against the United States, too?
Oh, absolutely. There's no other possible, well, I mean, they're possible, but there's no other likely use of ICBMs and SLBMs on that scale. Simply ridiculous to assume it's anything other than a very large nuclear strike against the United States combined with large nuclear strikes against our allies and our bases in abroad.
Now, Mark, the president in NATO summit context in London last week described the desire of the Russians to get into new arms control arrangements with the United States. He spoke as well of the possibility of bringing in the Chinese, if not right away, somewhat later. I don't know anybody in certainly our country, Mark, who has studied more closely, who understands more fully, and who has done more to document the real problems with our cumulative experience with arms control with the Kremlin under Soviet management and subsequently under that of the current president. What is going on here? What is the likelihood that something useful could come of these negotiations? And is there any reason to believe that we would have a better experience with the Russians in terms of compliance, in terms of verifiable agreements, or in any other way, something useful being the product of this process?
The chances of anything useful coming out of it is essentially zero. Now, the Trump administration has some very good people involved in this process, and they'll do a better job at it than almost anybody in the past. You have to go back to the Reagan administration to find a comparable period. But the bottom line is the Russians cheat. They do it massively, and they do it on every agreement. And when you have cheating on that scale, it really doesn't matter how good an agreement you get, because you're not going to get the actual implementation of it in the real world. So my view is there is literally zero chance that we're going to get anything useful out of the Russians. Now, China has consistently refused to get into any type of nuclear arms control negotiation, strategic or non-strategic, for its entire existence. And it comes up with one excuse after another. And recently, it really hasn't started making the excuses very much. It's just said no. And so you're not going to get the China involved in this. They'll just sit back and see what we do and cheer us on, hoping that we make foolish decisions.
Namely, foolishly dismantling what's left of our nuclear arsenal while they build theirs up. And Mark, this is always, of course, an important backdrop to these conversations with you. Remind our audience of where we are vis-a-vis the modernization of Russian nuclear forces, as best we can tell, Chinese nuclear forces, and the condition of our own nuclear forces. This is the context, of course, for any such negotiations, is it not?
Yes. There is a vast disparity between our modernization efforts and theirs. They have been actively modernizing their forces, and by that I mean actually bending metal, building systems, deploying systems since 1997. December of last year, the Russians said that 82% of their nuclear force had been modernized. It's higher now. Within a few years, it'll be 100%. But the real difference here is that, one, we have not modernized our systems at all since 1997 in the sense of introducing anything that's new or dramatically improved. And Russian modernization is never ending. When they introduce a new system, they start work, if they're not already at work, on a follow-on, either an improved version of the new system or a newer new system. We don't do that. We're talking about a minimal program of modernizing our triad, preserving it, and things won't start to be actually deployed for almost another decade.
And Mark, just very quickly, to just give our audience a sense of what this means, and strategically, what does it mean that we are facing adversaries who have not only enlarged their nuclear forces quite considerably, it seems, but built in a host of capabilities, some of which we may not really even fully understand as part of this modernization program, let alone configured our forces to be credible deterrents to their potential use in the manner that Vladimir Putin has been recently exercising on a massive scale.
Well, they have capabilities in many areas far more advanced than our own, not because their technology is better. It's not. It's because they put money in it and we haven't.
Their technology is new and in place, and ours is not, right? Our technology may have been better, particularly back in the 60s when a lot of this stuff was done. So, Mark, just in terms of a response to the president's suggestion here, your counsel is forget about it? Is that in a word?
It's forget about it, or at least as a precondition to any negotiations, they've got to terminate their ongoing violations of arms control treaties. And that, you know, the INF treaty in particular. Now, they've terminated, but that's the biggest material breach.
But there's another one that's looming. Just very quickly, Mark, we're almost out of time, but this New START treaty, is that presumably what they're going to try to perpetuate in some form, would you say?
The Russians, yes. I suspect that we will attempt to improve it significantly. There is, unfortunately, so many massive problems in it that may not be remotely possible.
Well, we will be coming back to you for further counsel on this one, Mark, because if the president's right that the Russians want it and it seems as though he's willing to pursue it, we're going to have to be very clear about what's afoot here and what needs to be done instead. Mark Schneider, again, I thank you so much and from the bottom of my heart, really, for your huge service to our country, both in government as well as that you're rendering these days at the National Institute for Public Policy. Come back to us very soon.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Well, following on the heels of our conversation about nuclear threats to this country, it's timely and highly important that we have an opportunity to visit with one of the country's preeminent experts on what it might mean if some of those nuclear weapons are used not in the manner that we have been talking about with Mark Schneider, a massive destructive laydown of thermonuclear weapons across the country, but perhaps even a single one detonated in space to unleash what's been known and described by our next guest as an electric Armageddon. He is, of course, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He has served in numerous capacities, including as an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency for quite some time, and as a key member of the congressional staff of the House Armed Services Committee, and on several vitally important commissions, including one that's near and dear to my heart, in particular the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Commission. Peter is a very accomplished author, both in periodical press as well as several books to his credit, including Apocalypse Unknown and Blackout Wars, as well as Electric Armageddon. And he's always a great friend and guest and colleague, and we're thrilled to have him with us. Peter Pry, good to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
Peter, you've written recently an important piece. They're all important, but in the company of several notable individuals as well, William Graham. Dr. Graham was the chairman, of course, of the commission on which you served so notably for so long, working on the EMP threat, and Jim Woolsey, R. James Woolsey, the former director of Central Intelligence. These are, together with yourself, kind of the best of breed in terms of national security thought and practice. Tell us about the thrust of this piece at Newsmax entitled Saving Electronic Civilization.
Well, basically, we were thrilled when earlier this year on March 26th, President Trump signed an executive order to require the U.S. government to protect the United States electric grid and other life-sustaining critical infrastructures from the existential threat from EMP. We've been working for more than 20 years to achieve that outcome, and President Trump is the first one to do that. And I might give myself a little credit here because you had arranged for me to meet President Trump before he became president, that when he was running in the Iowa caucus. And I had an opportunity to brief him, and he said to me, you know, don't worry, when I'm elected president, we're going to knock their heads together. He meant the departments and agencies of the U.S. government, and make this happen, because the chief bureaucratic obstacle had been that nobody wanted the hot potato that was EMP. Nobody wanted to be responsible for it. And the EMP executive order puts everybody in the hot seat, and it puts the president, the White House, in charge of managing what I call an EMP Manhattan project, which is supposed to get the country protected on a short line in a short period of time if the executive order is implemented competently. But the problem is that, as with all of President Trump's issues, he's got to deal with a government, a deep state, that is extremely resistant to anything he wants to do, including national EMP protection. You know, somehow the EMP Commission didn't get put in charge of implementing the president's EMP executive order. Instead, people in the Department of Energy and Department of Homeland Security have been put in charge of this executive order that have spent their professional lifetimes fighting against us, resisting trying to get the country protected from EMP. And they're basically trying to lowball the EMP threat with junk science studies by the electric power industry, in particular the Electric Power Research Institute, you know, which is not a legitimate alternative point of view. These people don't have any expertise on EMP. They represent the financial interests of the industry, and they have an interest in trying to so underestimate the EMP threat that the industry will end up having to do little or nothing about it. The worst outcome, so we could end up with the worst outcome here, which is an EMP executive order that misleads people into thinking the country has been protected from EMP, when in fact the implementation by the deep state bureaucracy leaves us completely vulnerable.
Peter, let me just drill down on this, because I think our audience has been exposed to some of your work and these issues with regularity, but still, it's important just to make sure all these vital dots are connected. We're talking here on the eve of the 78th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, about what could possibly be a Pearl Harbor of vastly more destructive potential for us and our people. And it's not just the Russians, or even the Russians and the Chinese. It's all manner of nuclear-armed states or people who might get their hands on nuclear weapons, or through other means besides electromagnetic pulse, could, you know, catastrophically attack our electric grid. And as you say, put electronic civilization at peril, extreme peril, perhaps existential peril. And you're describing, Peter, a president who's tried to knock heads together, directed the government of the United States to get this problem fixed at long last. And between those agencies that have proven so resistant to his leadership, indeed sabotaging him at every turn, and the electric utilities through their own activities and the sort of in-house think tank that they fund, this outfit known as EPRI, they're actively slow-rolling at best and simply blocking the faithful implementation of this program, of the president's, and getting us protected as we could be. Have I got that basically right? And if so, what on earth can we do to try to help the president get this job done?
You do have that correct. And I would like to add to that in the context of the Pearl Harbor. You know, I know you mentioned you had Mark Schneider on to talk about the Thunder 19 Strategic Forces exercise. Well, there was another exercise last year called Vostok 18. EMP can play a role in the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, even the Iranians, write in their military doctrines about how this could be a decisive, revolutionary new way of warfare, where you could basically win a war with the United States without a massive nuclear attack, just one weapon, as you described in the beginning of this show. But also, you know, in addition to the EMP from a nuclear weapon, which alone could do it, you could use non-nuclear weapons that could do it all by themselves, or you could use cyber attacks, or you could even use small teams of special forces to go in and shoot up transformers and control centers. And any one of those things on its own could impose a national blackout that would last over a year, which would kill 90% of our population through starvation, disease, and societal collapse. Their military doctrine calls for using all of these things in combination. And before the Vostok 18, which was the largest military exercise probably in world history, and featured a major nuclear attack against the United States, about a month or two before Vostok 18 was launched, it looks like they quietly did another exercise, because we detected all kinds of hundreds of U.S. Utilities were being attacked by cyber bugs, by viruses. And my interpretation of this is they were practicing two ways of war. The first was this revolutionary new way of war that they were doing quietly, you know, that where they could prevail without having to go to a large-scale conventional or nuclear war, but just by taking down our electric grids and our other life-sustaining critical infrastructures by means of cyber and sabotage and EMP. And if they had achieved, you know, that, they wouldn't have had to launch Vostok 18. But they did, of course, Vostok 18 anyway, you know, on the presumption that, well, we need to be prepared to fight the old-fashioned way,
yeah,
too.
Belts and suspenders. When you're trying to take down the United States of America, it's overkill for sure.
I can't help but think here we are on the eve of December 7th, okay, the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, and this country is so deeply divided because of impeachment and everything, and our adversaries have surely got to notice that. You know, as Mark Schneider pointed out, the Thunder 19 exercise, it was unprecedented in a lot of ways, not least in how they let us know what they were doing, and yet our mainstream media and the Congress is indifferent to that. You know, people talk about Congress and the government being paralyzed because of impeachment and neglecting things like, trade deals. There are much bigger things at stake here.
You're absolutely right. Peter Vincent Pry, your warnings on this count are incredibly important and deeply appreciated, especially your visits where you do them here. I hope you come back to us very soon, Peter. I hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.